Are you there?
Am I there?
You are there.
Are any of us really there?
I mean, yeah. Do you know you could send money with this new Skype? There's a money button. I could send you money, apparently. I don't know how that works.
Let's leave that untested. I mean, not that I wouldn't trust one of the buggiest pieces of software that I deal with on a regular basis with banking, but my banking apps are already buggy enough as it is.
Mm. Even Snapchat got rid of their money thing, or they're going to get rid of their money. I don't know if they did already. I don't use Snapchat.
I think they got rid of their money when they posted their user growth numbers. Zing!
That was good. That was good. This isn't the other show, though. This isn't the show where you do that.
No, no. Which show is this?
This is the one about movies. We used to talk about technology and things, like when we got bored or couldn't like think of a topic and stuff.
Yeah, or if you got like really angry at Red.
I don't even pay attention to them anymore. They're probably still doing dumb stuff. I could probably like go to their website and see all kinds of stuff to make me angry.
Yeah, we should do an episode where we check in on their phone situation.
Oh, right. Wasn't that supposed to launch, like, soon?
Yeah,
or
a little.
Did they miss that?
I don't know if they missed it, because I don't recall them setting a specific date as much as, like, some sort of nebulous thing about their, you know, weren't they, like, kickstarting it, basically?
Well, they took pre-orders, which they've always been fans of pre-orders with cameras and things too.
Yeah, pre-order is just an unbranded Kickstarter. It's a white label Kickstarter, but
that's true.
Yeah,
I forgot they've got these goofy new looking cameras now. A lot of people are doing this multiple native ISO thing where you can, you know, it's got a native 800 or a native 5000 ISO for low light or something, which isn't really how stuff works, but they're able to just like stick an extra chip in there for low light so you can switch over when you need it. They got one of those.
Wait, I'm confused. Does it change the sensor?
It routes it through a different A to D converter with a higher gain, and they've got a circuit path set for that, so it's not as noisy as taking an 800 native sensor and cranking it up to 5,000. It's like processing as if it was a native 5,000. The Panasonic Vericam was the first one to do that, and Red has one now called the Gemini because of the two.
Mm, clever.
Yeah. It's a 5K. It's a 5K Gemini Super 35. Mm-hmm. They've also got an 8K Super 35, and they got an 8K VistaVision. You got your Monstros, your Heliums, and your Geminis.
Mm. I'm a Sagittarius.
I'm a Cancer. I don't follow any of that.
Mm.
I don't. What was the name of their stupid phone? I don't even see it here on their the red forum.
I don't remember the name of it now, to be perfectly honest with you.
Hydrogen, is that it?
I think so, because Helium's the actual like camera that they had.
Okay, here's a thread called Hydrogen Pre-Orders from March. So, right, rollout, launch of Hydrogen, etc., etc. This is great radio, by the way.
Yeah.
Final May 19th notes. Oh, this is when they had their come look at it in person thing. Update April.
But don't record it, because it won't look as good, so we prohibit recording of it.
April 12th, 2018, 11 a.m. Late and better is better than just late. That's a good way to lead off your...
It's just like Kickstarter.
Carrier certification. Who could have known that was difficult?
You mean the phone has to be certified by a carrier?
What?
It's not just like a piece of equipment that you carry around with you who can swap in like an SD card. What if instead of calling people, you just got an SD card in the mail and you just plugged it in and that was your phone call? You'd have send back and forth little audio recordings.
Oh, that's kind of like that thing we were going to do for a while with the Dropbox.
Well, let us never speak of that again.
I just saw that folder the other day. I was like, oh, right. We were going to do another thing, and that never happened.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that the other week when I was setting up the computer. I was just like, what folders do I need to sync over? And I was like, oh, wait. I forgot that existed.
One with the name of a thing that we didn't do?
Yeah.
That's a great idea, except it's difficult enough for us to find time to do this show here.
You know,
this one here.
I think that people sometimes don't really appreciate or understand how difficult it is to actually manage to call someone on a regular basis and talk to them for a set period of time about a topic.
Seriously, if it was easy, like, I would have a better relationship with my family.
Apparently, I missed a call from the U.S. Census Bureau today, so I need to call them. I thought it was a junk call because, you know, it was a local area code number, and it was like, I know your tricks, but then they left a voicemail, and I was like, oh, you've intrigued me. Apparently, they're like, yeah, we haven't heard from you about the thing we sent you in the mail, and I'm like, did you send me something in the mail? I don't remember seeing it. So,
do you get a lot of spam calls these days? I get just probably a dozen a day. And it's typically the case that if I get like three or four in a week of the same number calling and not leaving a voicemail, that I'll just block it because I know it's spam. Like there's no reason to keep it going. But I have been less diligent about blocking those numbers recently, so they've kind of crept back up, and there are a lot of them again.
It's I have a very inconsistent sometimes it's like four in a day, and then other times it's like 2 months with nothing. So I don't really know how that winds up averaging out, but it is annoying. So I generally don't answer anything that has my local area code, and if they leave a message, then I know that it was probably a real thing. Also, I don't answer anything that's like Ohio or New Jersey or something else where it's like, why would anyone from there be calling me? Even if it's a missed number, I don't want to talk to them. So...
yeah, I generally don't want to talk to anybody ever.
Like, oh, I'm sorry, you got the wrong number. Oh, thank you so much. No, I don't want to have that interaction. You'll figure it out when you get the voicemail. Remember the old days when people used to call and get a wrong number and you have like a little conversation? Oh, I'm so sorry, I thought it was this number.
Yeah, no, that happened. Last time that happened was when I bought those Google ads. Remember when I bought those Google ads?
Oh, I forgot about that.
That was fun because they obfuscate your phone number with some sort of fake local phone number. So everyone thought I was in Atlanta, and everyone kept calling me asking how they could get cast in Tyler Perry movies.
Oh.
And I had a lovely conversation with a couple of people who were very interested in how they could be in some Tyler Perry movies.
Oh, speaking of Atlanta.
Oh, is that your segue? That's good.
We got to keep it tight and bright today. So I figure... at some point, we should probably talk about the movie. Yeah.
This week's this pretty much wraps up our Denzel Wagestisington.
Yes.
I still can't pronounce it properly.
Yeah, there never was a way to pronounce it properly.
It's our fourth installment for Denzel Wagestisington.
Yeah. Our it's a notable recent movie of his, and also. Robert Zemeckis, Bob's return to shooting things with like a camera.
As opposed to doing his Dead Behind the Eyes CG peoples.
Yeah, he was like, ah, shucks, I gotta get out of my home in Santa Barbara and go shoot something.
Is that where he lives, in Santa Barbara?
I think so. I think I remember hearing that somewhere. I don't know his like street address or anything. I haven't verified this information. Someone should start calling him and see if they get him.
See if he'd be willing to answer some questions for the Census Bureau.
This is his return to did they shoot this on film or digital?
I hope they didn't shoot it on film.
I think it was digital, but I rely on you for this. Sometimes
I'm clicking. Oh, you'll never guess what camera they shot it on.
Red Weapon?
Red Epic.
Oh, Red Epic. Okay. Well, I had a feeling it would be a red because the way you phrased that in a recent topic, but
we didn't even plan that. We didn't even try to do that.
No, it was the magic of...
You got Deluxe, you got Light Iron Outpost here doing your dailies and things and your DI.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of things with red. Light Iron. They got bought by who? Technicolor? Is that what it was? Panavision? Something? I don't remember.
I don't know. I think Technicolor owns almost everything, and then Deluxe owns almost everything else.
I think it's Panavision, though, because the Light Iron is the one who's developed the proprietary version of the proprietary color space for the red proprietary cameras that Panavision rewraps as Panavision cameras that are also proprietary.
Okay. I would just like to point out here, if anyone's listening and unfamiliar with red, their their red files are BS, and they're full of BS, and people do horrible things with them, and pass them around like, oh, look, I basically just baked in my color correction into the file, and it's like, did you?
No, they're flexible. They're flexible because they change the color science over time and get better and learn. So you can just go reprocess your old footage and it'll look better with the new color science.
Or just different.
Or different. You know,
or just
different,
not
different
the
highlight
same.
Roll off, more natural feelings and saturation mm-hmm. and things.
And then you can have a conversation with the colorist and you can be like, yeah, so well, I don't know why yours is saturated and ours isn't. Okay, well, let me describe it to you over the phone.
Are you on Dragon? You're on Dragon Color? Is that what you're on Dragon Color? Or you're on Red Gamma 4? You got Gamma 4 or Dragon Color?
Anyway.
Oh, you're on the IPPPP 2. Oh, we don't have that yet in our application. Our app doesn't support that yet, so it can't match. No, just put it on the red film, not the Cineon, the red film, and then it'll look real flat, and then you just do it by eye.
Did you get it all out of your system?
No, these are all conversations I've actually had. I have so many more conversations.
Not like Alexa color space. That's so simple. But
it is simple. There's only two instead of like eight, and it doesn't change over time. You just got the two.
Yeah, except you know there's some discussion about viewing it correctly.
It's actually not true. I downloaded a sample Alexa 65 file earlier today to look at, and they got a lot of different stuff in there. They got Alexa wide color. They got a P3 setting for it. They got camera negative. It's a mess.
Yeah. So anyway, fun stuff. The important thing here is that Bob got a camera and Bob shot stuff with the camera. And there are digital things in here. Things that are, you know,
computer generated things.
And it's fairly obvious which things they are.
Are you saying in a not so subtle way you didn't super enjoy the rendering on the plane?
You know, for the most part, I like the plane shots. There are a handful of them that I don't appreciate. During the disaster, when he's flying inverted and he goes over the apartment building complex, it's very crunchy and very contrasty and not as washed out as I feel like that should be. And when they use the camera footage,
the cell phone footage,
yeah, the smartphone footage, for some reason, it is of a very high quality, which I don't think that it should be in general. And on top of that, the CG is very crunchy and very contrasty. And you can see like the you can see shading in the smoke coming off of the.
Oh, the smoke is very bad in the cell phone footage. It looks very bad.
Yeah, because it's an overcast day. Like you wouldn't see like, you know, individual ridges on the smoke coming out of the engine exhaust. I question the decision to do that. I have to assume that there were notes like, oh, we want to see all the detail. We want to see the detail. We're paying you so much money. Like, why is everything so blurry? And then we are left with crunchy detail. So not a huge fan. But like, there's a lot of fun stuff in here before there's fire.
Fun stuff. I thought did we mention the name of the movie, by the way? We're talking about Flight.
Well, people can look at their podcast players.
Yeah,
so Zemeckis
and Denzel and then Airplanes and things. Mm-hmm. I thought the actual crash scene was incredibly like terrifying and realistic just very nerve-wracking to watch. I thought it was very well done.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I think that it really puts you into the movie in a very in a way where you know that this thing is going to crash, and you know because obviously you saw the trailer and you know what it's about, and you know how this is all going to go. Like he's not going to like land it all hunky dory at the end of this process. Sometimes if you have that knowledge ahead of time, you can be like, oh, well, this isn't that big of a deal. But I found myself like pretty wrapped up in it because you were cutting around to different things. I assume they had the whole fuselage on a gimbal or something. They were like turning that thing upside down, shaking it around. That I thought was very effective. Some long shots of like one of the when the flight attendant in the back of the plane unbuckled herself to go help with something, and what was her name, Katrina, or Ketiana or something? What was her name?
The first one, or yeah, the one that he was acquainted with?
The one he was acquainted with. Because the other
that was Katrina.
Yeah, Katrina. I think the other one was Camille or Camila. Katrina is like, you know, shouting from the other side, and we're cutting back and forth from the different perspective angles, and we're going back into the cockpit. And I thought that all of the stuff, including the way they laced the dialogue in between Denzel Washington and Tim Ratuni and co-pilot McJesus guy, I thought that sorry, not to be derogatory about religious belief, it's just that he has a singular characteristic in a later scene of this movie that just is a little weird. But
he was from the faculty, wasn't he?
I don't recognize him. He seemed familiar, but I didn't recognize him. Might be the not so great mustache, but
he was in the Hurt Locker too. That was another recent good one of his. The whiny kid in the Hurt Locker.
But yeah, this plane thing, that doesn't go so well for everybody. And it went
surprisingly well. I mean, it's definitely it's one of those movies that it's very much a movie. You don't expect to see like a based on a true story thing pop up or whatever, and like a nice little text across the screen telling what happened to them years later once the story had ended. So it's kind of great to know that there kind of aren't any bounds for the character. Like he's in this incredibly horrible situation and he's going to do the best he can, but like he's a great pilot in spite of his deep personal flaws, and he actually does some incredible things in this plane, which are like not beyond the realm of like human possibility. It's not like, you know, a superhero intervening or something, but it's great to sort of watch that like calm, cool, collected, like that's the pilot you want to have, is the like many decade veteran pilot who knows all of the tricks of flying because he's done it 1,000 times and he can do it in his sleep, and he knows what he needs to do to like save the most possible people while he's flying, and he's cool right up until the moment that he plows a giant aircraft into the ground, and that's super fun to watch, that competent pilot character.
And there is an added level of tension because we don't know in the audience how much of what he's doing is because of his mental state, and how much of it is because he's actually competent. Especially
they do a great job of setting up that doubt in the beginning of this movie.
Yeah, because with the especially the inversion when they flip the plane upside down, no one seems to believe that that is a good idea. However, of course, it is one of the things that saves the most number of lives, because they are able to get out of a populated area because they can sort of like glide on it and flip back around to gliding position and land belly up. So he does a lot of stuff where he manages, and there's doubt about his mental state that is from the first scene in this film on, and that involves him. Well, how should I say this? There is basically a gratuitous boob shot that starts the film. It's like an iHome hotel radio clock and an out of focus boob. So don't watch this with your kids.
you should have watched the FX Now version, because it is shot almost entirely in extreme close ups of people's faces.
Oh, geez.
And pan and scan, so you can't. There's none of that. So that's one of the major signifiers that I knew I was watching a different movie than you were. That was like the first comment you made. You're like, well, that was gratuitous. And I'm like, there's nothing in the scene. I feel like this is the scene Joe was talking about being gratuitous. And it's pan and scanned. It's not letterboxed properly. And it's shot from multiple camera angles instead of that sort of like one singular wide shot where Katrina's sort of like wandering around the room while he's on the phone. It's shot from many different very tight angles. Like, oh, I think I should probably watch the real version of this, because it also says it's shorter than the real movie too.
Yeah, did you watch the opening scene over again when you watched the real version?
I did, yes.
Okay. Would you think that the the nudity lent anything to the film in any particular way, or do you think it's just Bob being Bob?
It could definitely be considered gratuitous. I think the addition of sort of the casual sex mixed with the drugs and alcohol sets up his personal vibe pretty quickly, because he's clearly not in his 20s anymore, but he's definitely still partying. Like, he's, you know, like, this is his first job working as a pilot, and he's like in a new town every week, and he's just like partying it up in between flights. So I think the scene itself sort of lent itself to those elements. But yeah, when you shoot it as kind of like the wide master like that, there's not, it just kind of ends up being gratuitous, because like there's nowhere for anyone to go except like get up and put clothes on, which she didn't do. She got a cigarette or whatever.
Yeah, and then eventually put on underwear, and then eventually put on more clothes. But meanwhile, Denzel Washington is laying down and then sits up, and there is a sheet which blocks the lower part of his body, so that you don't even see like his stomach. And then he manages to get out of that scene without anything. So it's not that you have to, you know, you can't just like shrug your shoulders and be like, oh, well, that's the only way you could shoot a scene and have everybody believe everybody's naked. It's like, I don't know if I would go that far, but it's definitely a very rock and roll way to start your film, because Denzel Washington immediately does a line of cocaine, and we get that very interesting shot from above looking down at him. He seems a little high, and then
like that like camera that pushes in to like track along the line and into his face.
Yeah, he did a good job. And then they
just
they
like
have...
smash cut to him strolling out into the hotel hallway there, just looking as normal and collected as any person should be who's not been awake all night drinking and fornicating and full of cocaine.
Yeah, well, that's what the cocaine is for, as the movie explains to us, is that he gets drunk, and then he does cocaine to perk back up and be able to do his job. Mm-hmm. And this will become important later in the film. But this certainly lets you know the level that he's operating on when we first meet him, and how this accident could be perceived as being partially, in some way, his fault, or at least the death toll. Like, he could have done more better, I guess, is the way that they view it in the film.
Well, it's not even that. It's just like you broke the law. You mm-hmm. need to be punished for it, even though you achieved something that apparently nobody else could have possibly achieved. And it's almost like, in that same way, it's probably his argument, or just sort of the argument the audience is trying to make. It's like, it's almost that way where when somebody is drunk driving and they get in a car accident, they're like so relaxed that they're almost never injured, and the regular people that they hit are usually much worse off. Maybe this impairment led to his kind of calm, collected state where he was viewing things a little more slowly than everyone else and not getting the adrenaline pumping so he could maintain focus on what he needed to do. But it's great, because I mean there are no definitive answers as to, you know, what led to his performance and what inhibited him. It was just like, these are the events that unfolded, and these are the consequences that become of it, and he did an extraordinary job flying, but he was also totally screwed up on drugs and breaking the law, so he had to confront that. And then of course there's the entire movie is sort of just like coming to grips with, you know, addiction and responsibility and, you know, growing up, I guess.
Yeah. Does he grow up, really? I guess
he takes responsibility for his actions, and he actually, you know, in his little, his long speech there at the end, it sounds like he's looking forward to paying off his debt in the appropriate and to the fullest extent required by him, so he can become an honest member of society again.
Yeah, we assume. I think one of the ways they could have it's easy for him to have that outlook on life inside of the jail, outside of the prison, because he has no access to the recreational activities that he was taking advantage of earlier. So
I mean, theoretically, it'd be more difficult, but I think.
Let's not talk about jail. Yeah. Well, it's true, but so I guess he's on the straight and narrow now because he doesn't make anything and distribute anything illegally. But
he's writing a book too, and you kind of get a little bit of a hint of like his underlying desire to want to like clean himself up. He's not completely self-destructive because like after the crash, when he's in the hospital for, I don't know what, like a week or whatever, like he's of course detoxed from all of that stuff by necessity, except for the painkillers that they've been giving him. And, you know, when he leaves, he, you know, decides not to drink and he empties all the booze out and he kind of like wants to go be clean for a while. But he ends up succumbing to weakness pretty quickly when in the face of, you know, stress and things like that, which are triggers for this sort of stuff. But I think the thing that they're trying to give us at the end there is, you know, yeah, the prison also restricts his access. But of course, now the prison managed to restrict his access long enough for him to both get clean and to sort of like stop lying and then rebuild his support system of having his family, obviously. So that's the one thing that when he was sober and still lying to everybody, his family wanted none of his crap. But when he's starting to take responsibility for himself and be sober and be honest, you know, his kid wants to hang out with him and, you know, maybe his ex-wife will talk to him a little bit and he's got a new girlfriend who wants to hang out with him instead of run away because he's an addict and she's trying to get clean too. So, you know, it's really, it's about the friends we made along the way. Sorry, I couldn't help saying that, but I do believe that. I think, you know, that's obviously the point of it all is, you know, it's, you've got your AA meetings in there. You've got your family dynamic stuff. It's really about the support outside of just like, okay, I can stop drinking now. Okay, I'm drinking again. I'm stopped drinking now. It's like, well, just the act of stopping for a while doesn't make you a sober person. You also need to come clean with all of these lies and things that you've done and take responsibility and then rebuild the relationships that you screwed over when you were being a lying alcoholic.
Yeah. I will say one thing that bothered me in the course of this film, just from a strategic level. I'm talking strategy. Strategy, not ethics or anything like that, was right the night before the trial, after 9 days and whatever hours and minutes sober he was, they put him into a hotel room with a guard on the outside and no one inside to watch him and a full mini bar, and they knew that he had a
his
problem.
His mini bar was empty.
Wait, where was the full mini bar?
The full mini bar was the adjacent room, which the housekeeping didn't like lock the thing.
Oh, right, because he got up in the middle of the night because he thought somebody was knocking.
Yeah, it was the lock was extended, but the window was open. It was banging it against the thing, and then it was the neighbor mini bar. And you were like, "Oh, he's gonna show restraint here. He's gonna do it. Like he recognizes that he's gonna do it." It's like, no, it's not how addiction works.
Oh, the shot of him slowly screwing back on that lid and then putting it on top of the mini bar fridge center frame. And the camera just lingers on it, and you're like, "Oh, this is the Inception top. Only I know this one's gonna fall over." And sure enough, he reaches in and he grabs the bottle, and there's a little sound effect when he does it too.
Like so snatches it too, yeah. And you're like, "Oh, I have hope." He put the cap back on and he set it back down, and it's like it lingers there so long. You're like,
"Nope."
He put it down on top of the thing, which. Maybe he's doing that so he can like stare it down and be like, "Yeah, I beat you." It's like, no, he didn't put it back in the fridge. He put it right there where it's easy to grab. Oh, there's the hand, and we're drunk.
Well, for a brief second, before his hand comes in, I was like, maybe they're gonna do a cheese ball dissolve to like daylight streaming in and showing the bottle still there. And then I was like, no, I don't think this is that kind of movie. And he, sure enough, his hand swipes it. Yeah. Little kids today don't understand that you can just dissolve between two different lighting things, and then you can say that that's the passage of time. But instead, we get the passage of time in Bruce Greenwood and Don Cheadle walking up outside and entering to a bit of a mess.
Like an astounding mess, too. And it's obviously played for comedy, this whole, like, circus that they have to go through to just, like, get him, first of all, off the floor of the bathroom. Like, he's got a head wound. He's bleeding on the toilet. Like, he's blacked out. They got to sober him up. They're feeding him coffee, and he's mumbling something about, like, his friend. And we met bowling shirt John Goodman earlier in the movie, who's sort of his, I don't know, like his Grateful Dead touring buddy or something from back in the day.
His Big Lebowski character again.
Yeah, well, his Big Lebowski character on like four different types of drugs all at the same time, just banging around the city doing whatever it is he does with his Bob Marley knit backpack or whatever.
And his Southern lawyer voice.
Yeah, that was
remember when he was the Southern lawyer in the B movie?
Yes. Also, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He's he plays a character named Big Dan.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's his dealer slash old pal or whatever, and he comes in and he gets him straightened out. He gets him the correct amount of cocaine to make him appear normal again, which disturbingly totally works right up until Denzel's conscience gets in the way in his hearing, I think they did it appropriately. It was motivated appropriately. His self-preservation instinct was finally broken by, really, he had to throw his dead girlfriend under the bus and say she was the one drinking and being an alcoholic, and he genuinely appeared to care for her in the beginning of the movie, even though they were both screwed up, and he just couldn't betray the memory of a dead person that he liked slash dated, so he decided that that was too much and needed to come clean.
Mm-hmm. And that treachery was, of course, because at the beginning of the movie, he takes two bottles of vodka and fills up part of an orange juice bottle with it, even though there is no drink service because of the rough takeoff that they have had. And how much of that rough takeoff was due to him in his state, it was unclear. And that's one of course, the other things that gives you that tension during the crash scene. But he continues to drink in the front of the thing. And when he's confronted about these bottles later on, he tries to deny it and also then doubles back and says, oh, well, there were really three bottles, because he's in a mood. when he drinks to excess, like many people who do, he gets a little unpleasant.
Mm. It's also great that they picked Denzel for this role too, because through all of these movies that we've watched and talked about, I think one of the key factors for Denzel is his just innate charisma in any role, and somebody who is like woefully addicted to anything and has to lie about it on a regular basis. If they were as charismatic and still somehow functioning as Denzel is in this movie, like they could go for decades without ever really being discovered until, you know, you have this sort of act of God event that basically puts you unconscious in an ambulance where they're going to draw your blood because that's part of the procedure. And there's nothing you can do about that because they have it. So, yeah. Now you're caught.
Well, and the while we had just talked about Man on Fire, his character in that was also an alcoholic who was dealing with his stresses through alcohol from his past career and life. That movie has, you know, the cold turkey, you know, switching it off like a light switch when he's got to go do his, you know, serious child rescue stuff, and when things are going well in his life, and when he nearly commits suicide with the pistol to his head. So,
did you enjoy the resurgence of his alcoholic "I need a drink" facial tic from Man on Fire slash in this one, where he's sort of like swirling his tongue around his mouth?
It's very similar, I would say. Yeah.
He's got that thing. He's not really like chewing on his tongue, but he's sort of like moving his mouth around with his lips closed, and that's very much his like, I sure could go for a drink because I'm feeling some pain right now.
Deep
down inside.
He does a very believable job, doing this role. And while I don't like him, I feel like I don't want to see him continue to fall further and also ruin everybody else's life around him. So you do kind of root for him through the course of the film, even though he is like a very textbook, super gross and unpleasant person. But you can see the appeal of him on occasion, like why people would want to be in his life, like why Margaret would want to be around him after knowing him for all of these years, why when he meets Nikki, why she would want to be around him, and also why she would be driven away from him. So it's interesting to see that take place in the film.
Yeah, I thought it was managed to, you know, it told the story of the dealing with the addiction and the family and friends stuff in an interesting way, obviously framed by this incredibly unusual event of this plane crash and this character who is the pilot. But I don't know, I felt like everything that they went through and they did, I mean, maybe with the exception of like eating the can of spinach and turning into the strong Popeye character when he does his cocaine in the morning. Like, I feel like everything else was pretty realistic to the way these characters can and should behave. Even, you know, the incredibly self-destructive, like, relapsing tendencies and scenes. And you get your, like, the scenes where he gets super drunk and he's watching his home videos or whatever, and then he, like, falls over the coffee table and basically sleeps on the floor. Like, all of that stuff is, it's like serious and heartbreaking and realistic. And, it's just this crazy weird movie about the pilot that surrounds it.
Yeah. I will say, since we had just talked about Nikki, I didn't quite understand where things were going at the beginning of the movie when we were cutting back and forth between, Denzel's day, for his plane crash and her day for her drug crash. They didn't seem to coordinate in any way, and it's not until after in the hospital scene when they meet each other in the stairwell that you're like, oh, okay, so there you are.
Yeah.
And then you feel
the multiple timelines.
Yeah, and then you feel like that would again resurface when she leaves, in a bolder way, I guess, or in some way, like maybe we cut back to see how she's doing or something. I don't know. It was a little weird to focus so heavily on her and then just be like, okay, now she's gone from the film.
did you have any particular feelings about who she was when we first saw her and didn't know anything about her?
How do you mean?
Well, because all we got from Denzel is that he was arguing with presumably an ex-wife on the phone. I thought for a moment that maybe it was her, even though there was no kid. Like, maybe he was an addict and he was previously married to another addict. Not like he was an addict who was married to somebody who had their stuff together and they're just arguing about that kind of thing. I had that thought for a moment, but then, yeah, once you see the two of them together, you realize that is not the case.
Yeah. I would say that in the first shot where she's pulling up and parking and stuff, I had that thought briefly, but then I was like, if she was in a relationship with him, she wouldn't really be having this conversation about the kid going to private school and stuff when it seems like she's not in a situation where she can afford a whole lot of stuff. So that feels like that's somebody else. So I got that it was somebody else, but I think the part that was weird for me was not finding out how she threaded into this until the stairwell scene.
Did you think that they were fated to meet, as a co-pilot guy said?
I believe that is what the movie was going for, because the writer told us that in dialogue, but
they were fated to meet and she was fated to want to get clean so she didn't die, and that would help push him into wanting to do the right thing, because He lost another person that he sort of cared about.
Yeah, and also to contrast her picking herself up versus him descending further into having problems.
They're buddies who are going to wallow in their self-pity together until she decides not to do that anymore and wants to be a better person. And he's like, what are you talking about? Let's just get drunk and have fun.
Yeah, and he actually gets quite upset with her about that, because he even yells at her, like, you go to two AA meetings and you think that, you know, you're done and blah 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 blah. But I found it to be I liked her performance. I just didn't like the way the character was dealt with in the film. I didn't have an issue with how she delivered her lines or anything. Kelly Riley, apparently the name of the actress, although I don't think I've seen her in anything else.
What's his name? Oh God, why can't I think of his name? Jude Law's wife in the Sherlock Holmes movies by Guy Ritchie.
Oh, I saw the first one of those a long time ago when it was in theaters, and then didn't watch any of the other ones.
There's only two. She's in both of them. Apparently, she was also in Pride and Prejudice and something called Eden Lake.
Oh, well, she's English, so I guess that makes sense.
Is she?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, look at that, English.
Yeah. Although, I will say, she does a better job with her southernness than some of the American people in the film. I feel like her landlord in particular, the gross, skeevy landlord... His performance left a lot to be desired. Not just
his character didn't have a ton of dimension to it.
No, it was just gross guy who wants to sleep with her, and extract money from her, et cetera. But I mean, we didn't need to have a lot of dimension because we don't see him for the rest of the film. He's in like two scenes, but it's still.
He's also in that shot you didn't like where the plane's going over top of the apartment complex.
Yeah, but his performance just left something to be desired because it's so, like, I don't know, made for TV movie. I would say that while I like Bruce Greenwood an awful lot, performance with the accent, you could just have Bruce Greenwood talk like Bruce Greenwood and that would have been fine. I don't understand the temptation to be like, oh, we're in the South, so everybody must talk like a Southern lawyer now.
Well, you know, all of the best Navy pilots were Southern.
But I mean, because like Tamara Tooney, you know, who plays Margaret, she is from the Atlanta area in the film, and she doesn't have any sort of weird performance issue. Neither does Denzel Washington. For some reason, it's just John Goodman, Kelly Riley, and what was it? Bruce Greenwood. And that's it. They all have like a weird thing they're doing. Oh, and Southern Jet owner baseball guy. He's a character.
What is he from? He's from a lot of things. I don't even remember his name. I'm trying to... Which one was he? Peter Garrity? Is this guy?
Yeah, Abington Carr. Yeah.
Oh, what a great name. Charlie Wilson's War, Public Enemies. Oh, that's right, Public Enemies. He was a mobster. Paul Blart Mall Cop. Oh, yeah. He's got a long...
He's got a lot of stuff.
Here. Yeah, a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
He plays a good arrogant white guy.
Yeah. I do actually think it's interesting his viewpoints that he has as the owner of the airline, because he doesn't seem to care about the airline. And he doesn't really care about what happens to it. He just doesn't want the rest of his stuff to be liable. And when he hears about what had happened with Denzel Washington's character, he's just like, oh yeah, no, he's gonna go to jail and blah 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 blah, because he has this sense of what is right, despite the fact that it would actually cause him a financial loss, which is
interesting. Everybody here caused this mess and I want all of you to pay for it and not me, because I have better things to do.
Yeah, And then he has that disingenuous moment where he's like, oh, you know, I've heard interesting things about you or something. You're quite a pilot. They tell me you're quite a pilot, but I think that it does a decent job with his airline-y-ness and stuff.
It's airline-y-ness?
Yeah, I don't know. He just seems like a guy who has a lot of money, and he just doesn't really care about something. But yeah, it's interesting.
I was gonna say, I was just looking through some of these photos here. The one scene that I felt was a little, I don't know, gratuitous in the sense that it was just like, we're gonna build on some characters here and hang out and talk about some stuff that might not be relevant, is when they were hanging out on the porch at Dad's farm or whatever, and she was giving her spiel about her life story and he was talking about himself. It was just like, okay, we're gonna stretch our legs and really, we're gonna really live inside the skin of these characters for a little while. It's like, well, I don't know what the scene's really doing. I think that's the one where he took the photo of her, so we needed that for the callback later. But it just very much felt like a monologue that a writer really wanted somebody to read on camera.
There are a few moments like that in this film, but yeah, I agree. Because we also get all that information through the process of watching the film. Like, if you're in her apartment at the beginning of the movie, when she is going to shoot up, you see all the photos of her with her mother and various stages of their life. And you can piece together very quickly that her mother had cancer by virtue of the movie symbolism of the attire that she is in the photograph. And the... that since this character is so depressed and so out of it, that it must mean that she is no longer with us because she's so ruined now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So then when you have her actually explicitly say that later, it's like, oh, but we got that because we watched the whole thing with the pictures and stuff and the drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, we got at the moment where the characters learn these things about each other too. It's just one of those ones that we were ahead of them on that one, which it was fine. I mean,
yeah. It could happen off camera, too. Like, we literally witness every moment of their lives. You know, watch them pee.
I mean, Denzel spends a fair amount of time in the bathroom.
Touché.
Smoking or on his face or just whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely an acting slash character movie, which is... Yeah, I was just looking. It was nominated for Academy Award for Denzel and for the writing, which, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it seems like the kind of movie that would get it nominated for writing.
By the
Academy.
Did you take a gander at the guy who wrote this?
No, I haven't. Gattens?
John Gattens.
Okay, John Gattens.
Written by here. He has one other written by, two other written by credits, Coach Carter and Dreamer, inspired by a true story. He has screenplay credits on Real Steel, story by credit on Kong Skull Island, and screenplay credit on Power Rangers, and then some other things that you've never heard of. He's written 10 things, and he's an actor as well.
Oh.
So this is a standout movie for him. Oh, Need for Speed. He wrote the story for Need for Speed.
Was there a story?
I mean, you know, it's a Breaking Bad boy in a fast car or whatever.
Mm.
He drives around. There was a bunch of GoPros, I think. That one was, I believe, DP'd by our friend, our crazy Terminator friend. What's his name?
Oh,
Shane Hulbert. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was nice.
Interesting. Anyway,
I've seen 5 minutes of it. It's a very bad movie.
I mean, I don't want to harp too much on the writing. Because I think this is, for the most part, well-written.
Yeah, I agree.
It's just when they get monologue-y that it's just like, okay, writer.
Yeah, I mean, but that's, you know, you could get that in editing. And by all accounts, maybe they should have, because this movie is 2 hours and 18 minutes. And, I mean, it doesn't feel like... I mean, there is a ton of stuff in here. I don't know that there's a ton of stuff that you could excise and keep the same feeling, because, I mean, the whole point is this journey of, like, he gets another chance, and he falls on his face. He gets another chance in a different direction, and he falls on his face. So it's like, you kind of need to take that journey with him, as there are all of these trials around him with regard to the actual crash. So I think it's good, but yeah, at 2 hours and 18, you could remove a little bit of that.
I agree. Also, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
The music.
Yeah, there was music in this. There was some Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I remember the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Was there more?
Well, I don't remember all of them. Was there a Bob Dylan or a Steely Dan or whatever?
Probably. There was a song in the end credits, which I thought was pretty good. That's what you call it. Feeling All Right.
Yeah, it just feels like, Feeling All Right, they played a couple. It feels like all of the sort of vintage 70s stuff, they played like more than once in the film, kind of.
Although, and, the one thing I did roll my eyes at was Sweet Jane by the Cowboy Junkies, the really soft song she's playing when she's doing her drugs. That didn't work for me because that's also the same song that Tarantino used in one of his heroin scenes in Pulp Fiction, I believe. So, no credit for originality there. you get your Sympathy for the Devils, your Gimme Shelters, Ain't No Sunshine. Mm-hmm. Let's see here. What's Going On, Marvin Gaye.
Yeah. What's weird is you have Alan Silvestri on this movie. I can't think of anything in the film score that Alan Silvestri did.
I mean, was there score during the crash, or was it just all sound and performance?
I feel like it was mostly just sound. So I'm sort of like scratching my head over what it was. I mean, maybe there was stuff laid in there and I just missed it.
Maybe in the beginning there. I think the opening credits maybe had some score.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a lot of needle drop tracks in this one.
Mm.
Red Hot Chili Peppers were there, being annoying as they normally are.
Mm-hmm. As they are wont to do.
The Bare Naked Ladies had a song called Alcohol, which was apparently in there. Okay.
Hmm.
There's some good songs in the soundtrack.
Oh, well, that's nice. You can cue it up later. And
with a little help from my friends, it's a good song.
But I mean, I don't know if there's much more to say about this one. I feel like it's
how many stars you give it out of 5?
4.
I gave it a 4 as well.
Huh. I didn't realize we were doing star ratings, but I
put it on the internet ranking website for movies that I don't think you participate in.
No, it's just so much trouble.
so much trouble to hit a button to select 4 stars. You don't have to type a review every time, but this was a good movie because it's convoluted, it's silly, it's a little far fetched in places, but it's really it's one of those movies where people get to stretch out and like really get into a character role and put on their character hats and character coats and drink their character alcohols. I don't know where I'm going with this, but it was good. It was fun to watch and it felt real.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel similarly. Also, so happy that Robert Zemeckis didn't do this all like motion capture. God,
I wouldn't be surprised if there was some motion capture in the people flopping around in the airplane when it was like crashing and stuff.
No, I feel like there was a very conscious effort to rein it in from his. Is a little extreme jaunt in the 2000s.
Although, I mean, we've seen a lot of ridiculous motion capture in movies like Jurassic World. Maybe somebody was playing the airplane. I mean, you got people playing velociraptors for some reason.
Don Cheadle uncredited.
Don Cheadle uncredited as the airplane. He's got all that experience playing War Machine. He knows how to fly.
Yeah, exactly. That was a bit... You know, Zemeckis is thinking.
And Andy Serkis as orange juice bottle.
Yeah.
Denzel's good. He should have won something for this.
Yeah, well, he was nominated, though. So, who won instead of him, though?
That is a good question.
I always like to look at who won instead of somebody else and then be like, no, you shouldn't have, etc.
Let's take a look here. Daniel Day-Lewis and Lincoln.
Oh, God.
Oh, it was also up against The Master, which I've heard is a very good movie and I've never seen.
How should I phrase this? I have no interest in seeing The Master because I have no interest in ever watching another Paul Thomas Anderson thing.
Hmm.
I know he did Phantom Thread and everybody was like losing their ish over that, but I don't know. There's just something so Paul Thomas Anderson about Paul Thomas Anderson movies that it just rubs me the wrong way. Much of the same way Wes Anderson. Basically, nobody named Anderson can direct a movie that I want to watch.
Those two don't get put in the same category.
Not for the same attributes. I'm just lumping them together because the last name.
Well, it
also
was,
Paul W.S. Anderson.
Oh yeah, well, that's just the exception that proves the rule right there.
Yeah, Anderson's a cursed name is all I'm saying.
It's not. Anyway, he was also up against Hugh Jackman for Les Miserables and Bradley Cooper for The Wonderful Silver Linings Playbook from our favorite director.
Oh, I didn't see that one either. I heard good things about that one.
It's David O. Russell.
Yeah, I know. You hate him.
I do hate him, yeah. Which is interesting. Jennifer Lawrence won for Silver Linings Playbook that year. I actually just listened to... I'm finally going through my backlog of podcasts, and I listened to a bunch of Marc Maron's. And, of course, I fast-forward for the first 15 minutes or whatever.
But what about Stamps.com and where he's going to be in Portland?
You can't fast-forward fast enough to miss the hey folks at the beginning of the episode. It's literally what he opens every episode with. So I always hear that, and I'm like, I remember when I did that thing.
Yeah.
But Jennifer Lawrence was in there talking about David O. Russell and some stuff like that. And it was a good episode listening to her talk about stuff. But it hurt me.
Did she like working with him?
She loves working with him.
Oh, that is so weird. Because not everyone has that opinion of him.
Yes, she has a personality that I think works well with his.
Oh.
Take that how you will, but I don't know how to take that. I think she called him a genius at one point, and I was like, let's not be quite so hasty with that. Silver Linings Playbook was, okay movie in the pantheon of David O. Russell movies. But yeah, he gets a little bit more credit than I think he deserves.
Ooh.
That was my polite David O. Russell punditry there.
Not a big fan of, what was it, Three Kings?
Three Kings, I liked because Clooney and, what's his name?
Wahlberg?
No, the other one, the crazy one, from Jackass. Spike Jonze.
Oh.
There's some good Spike Jonze and some good Clooney in there.
Interesting.
Yeah. And Ice Cube, he's good there.
That's nice.
Have you seen Three Kings? Have you not seen Three Kings?
I've seen it, but it was like, I don't know, 15 years ago.
Yeah, they did that. They did that Bleach bypass thing, and there's some like strobe stuff. There's some really weird cinematography in that movie.
Remember the early 2000s when everybody was like Bleach bypass?
There's this process called Bleach bypass, and it does this really cool thing where it makes the black levels like super crunchy and black, and then everything else is still kind of like washed out a little bit. It's really cool looking. Yeah.
AI, Minority Report, War of the Worlds.
One of the first things I learned to do with regard to color correction in Apple Color, if you remember Apple Color that came bundled with the Final Cut Studio, was learn how to recreate a Bleach bypass look in Apple Color.
I didn't do that, but I learned how to create a Bleach bypass look in Shake.
It was still that same sort of like you take a monochrome version and then you you like blur the blacks, then you like add the blacks back over top of the image or whatever.
I don't remember exactly, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, you add some contrast, you make a black and white image, you put the black back over top the image, and overlay mode keeps the dark part and not the light part.
People do funny stuff with film.
Mm-hmm.
I recently watched something about like recreating like the Kodachrome look of the 50s. It was very involved and interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily see a reason to do it unless you're doing a period piece.
Oh, was that the one where they were you push everything towards like R, G, and B so you don't have really the secondary colors?
Yeah.
That's actually a kind of cool look. It gets really funky really fast if you push on it too hard. But yeah, I saw that too. That was kind of cool. I was like, oh, this is a neat technique that I have no idea when I would ever use unless I was like making Pleasantville 2 or something.
No, like I said, period piece stuff. Like, or you know, when you want something to be like that really sort of saturated Wizard of Oz kind of a look. But yeah, it was so weird to watch that and think, when would I use this? And then why am I watching this if I'm not going to use this? But it's still interesting. Mm-hmm. Just the way that, you know, we play with light stuff.
Yeah. Mm. For image processing, I was recently watching, I like to watch the Red Giant, the tutorials and the things that they put out there from time to time. And, you know, Stu's stuff where he does mm-hmm. like walkthroughs of the products and things. I was watching the one on Magic Bullet Renoiser, which I own. And, I don't do a ton of denoising and renoising, and I probably should, but he made, mention of one of the, presets for the renoiser, which adds just a very slight amount of noise to your image for the intent of breaking it up just enough so that codecs, when they compress for web, don't band because there's just enough mm-hmm. noise in the image to keep it looking nice. And I was like, wow, it's an idea that I've never actually pondered before. And since I'm in the middle of finishing up a motion graphics piece, I am going to add this. And I threw it on there. I'm like, that actually looks really nice. And we'll see how the compression comes out afterward.
Yeah, I am aware of that technique for banding, but usually
do you do that? Do you ever get like something all the way to the client and they're like, why is this banded all stupid? This has to go on TV like this. And you're like, I have a fix.
Well, no, because I'm traditionally working with something that has grain, so it needs grain integration stuff.
Mm.
If you're working with like motion graphics in a completely artificial environment, then yeah, I could understand that. But even on all CG pictures that I've worked on, there's a show standard grain approach that you put onto it just to prevent banding and also to add some life kind of to mm-hmm. it because otherwise you get something that's completely static.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
I'm kind of on a grain kick right now too. It didn't actually start with Stu's Renoiser video. It started with Seth Worley doing his Q&As on Instagram, talking about all of the Visco presets that he uses, and he mentioned that he puts a lot of grain on his images. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess you do. I never really thought about the fact that you're adding grain to these images, but it adds something to it. And it looks nice. And then I just totally stole everything he was doing to his images, and I've been doing that to mine.
It had occurred to me. But I don't want to say anything negative about Seth.
You don't like the grain?
I don't like the grain.
A little bit of grain.
It's good. It's good. It's good to have a style. It's good to have a thing. It's not a thing that I would do.
It looks more like an image that has been, that has a look applied to it than just like I captured this with my phone. And if you are looking for something that says something other than I literally did the minimal amount of effort to capture an image and put it online, I think it's another way of just sort of signaling like, hey, I did some stuff to this and I meant it to look like this.
Yeah. I like, for example, what he does with color. So
just don't like the grain.
But you know, I'm a bit of a fuddy-duddy. Like if you flip through like photos that I take, and you see how I process things, it's like, oh, that's pretty boring, Joe. It's just kind of looks mostly like plain and not all that interesting or contrasty. It's like, yes, I know.
It's plain Joe-ane.
Yeah, I would have gone with average Joe, but
That's from the Dodgeball.
Mm.
Did you watch the Dodgeball?
The movie Dodgeball, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's average
Joe's gymnasium.
It doesn't hold up super well, FYI, if you were tempted to revisit.
Oh, in terms of problematicness?
Super problematic.
It's not terribly surprising for a Vince Vaughn movie.
Yeah. Who could have predicted? But, you know, still some good stuff.
Mm. One of those movies aged out real fast, didn't they?
Yeah. All right, well, we gotta wrap this one up. Let's glide into a smooth landing that does not in any way destroy a church and is caught on the world's best smartphone camera, which is obviously a prototype red hydrogen that somebody in the congregation had.
And 4View 3D or whatever. If you would like to end on a sad but realistic note in line with this movie, also nominated that year and winner of Best Directing in 2013 when Flight was nominated, was Ang Lee, who won for Life of Pi. Remember when Ang Lee won for Life of Pi?
I mostly remember when the VFX guy won and was played off the stage, and I remember when Claudio Miranda won for cinematography for a movie that's all about digital things that he didn't really shoot. So that's this one,
Life of Pi.
Yeah, that, yeah.
So this is the year when Ang Lee and the cinematographer both thanked their cast and crew and said nothing about the VFX. And then they got these Oscars. And then, what, like a month later, that company went out of business.
Yeah, bankrupt.
Mm, Rhythm and Hues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's all this special you can watch on YouTube.
Yeah,
all
I've
about
seen
that.
Most of
it's
it.
It's a little one-sided and like, oh, you know, we just thought that we would just keep doing things even though we had no money and bid through the floor for that.
We made some very poor business decisions, but we figured everyone with their large, kind hearts in Hollywood would just sort of help us out as we got into trouble and didn't really pan out. No, that's an unkind way to put it. They were sort of victims of circumstance, but yes, of course, the fact that they kept working kind of doomed themselves. Anyway, they won Best Oscar for Visual Effects, too.
Yeah, congratulations. Mm-hmm. But,
The end.
Da 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 da.